Chapter 31 Land Brother Meissen. I stood waiting impatiently in the shade out in the field in front of the dike tower, as the Seven Dori now called the sprawling wall, ditch and tower complex that fortified the entrance to my domain. The only reason I was in shade was the opaque field of magic over my head that cast a shadow I could hide under, a test of the War Mage Beethless' command over his new witchstone. Beethless was just as hot as I was, but was so happy with his ascendance that he ignored it to demonstrate his worthiness. It was bad enough I had to come here in the first place. I didn't need to bake in this heat. The weather was unseasonably hot for the late spring. Summer was still a few weeks away. The magical shade was designed to intimidate. If Sire Gimble wanted to negotiate, he'd have to bring his own shade. I didn't really want to treat with the dislikable man, but I had been informed that it was considered ignoble to refuse. The truce talk had been arranged by Land Brother Meissen, a monk who tended a small temple to Huin in Sestalia, but who had grown up in Brestol village. He was popular with the peasantry, as most land brothers are, and the monk preached a humble piety that was popular with the nobility, for the peasantry. He and his brethren ran a small hospital and school alongside the temple. He had requested the truce because he was tired of hearing his pilgrims complain of running afoul of Westflarian troops when they made pilgrimage to his shrine. The acrimony had turned our frontier into a fortress, and the flow of trade had gotten a lot more expensive. When the water stopped flowing out of the valley and his fields began to dry up, the lord of the domain on our borders, Sire Mortaran of Bastador, quietly asked Brother Meissen to intervene in Huin's name. The monk proposed the meeting, offering to act as intermediary in the interests of the temple, under holy offices. I accepted, of course, because I'm a talkative kind of guy, and I wasn't stupid enough to go pissing off a popular monk. That's almost never a good thing for a noble to do. Apparently Sire Gimble understood that as well. But the warbird was late, it was hot, and I was getting cranky. That's when the first contact came from Terlaman. Minilin, the Gavani sent two legions raiding into northern Gilmora last night. Terlaman's measured mental tones informed me without preamble. Over 4,000 of them, along with some human turncloaks or soulless, acting as a cavalry screen. But that's not the big news. The big news is the five legions they sent past Kriskuk, past Don Valin and past Castle Kreiters on the Lumber Road, all of which we figured they would stop to invest. They aren't. They throw just enough scrugs at them to keep them tied to their castles, and they move on south without pause. They're making more than 20 miles a day, and the next large target in that direction is Barrowbell. I thought about the implications of what he reported. That would be strategically bad, I replied. It would indeed. If they take Barrowbell, then all the western riverlands are open to them, and they enjoy a clear path down to the Al-Shari coast. Well, don't let them, I ordered my military commander impotently. He chuckled. That's going to be hard, he admitted, but not impossible. They cleared 1,000 lances at Flassalan like it was harvest time, and the battle slowed them no more than a day. Once they get to the riverlands, we're going to have to face them in force, or deal with a lot more than mere raids. What do you need to stop them? I knew the answer, but I felt obligated to ask anyway. I just need more troops, a lot more, and some way to keep dragons off of their backs. We've squeezed the locals dry, and they're starting to waver when we go recruiting. I've got more peasant levies arriving at Sword Point every day from the east, but they aren't enough. We've exhausted the mercenary pool. We're arming the refugees and forcing them to fight. The ducal troops have yet to depart their southern encampments. If that column gets to Barrowbell, I know. Disaster. Barrowbell is in the heart of the Riverlands, one of the jewels of Gilmoran cotton country, where the Lumber Road becomes the Cotton Road, around which sprawls the rich rolling hills and fertile riverlands that produce the prized textile. It was also one of the largest cities in Castal, and the major overland transfer point between two important rivers. The strategic importance of the site was seen the moment men laid eyes on it. From the Dreadwell to the Forakeen overland, it was only around 20 miles, and Barrowbell was 10 miles from each side. It was where the Cotton Road ended, and the great barge is left with most of the Gilmoran cotton crop every year. Barrowbell was always a market town. It was protected by a massive black castle, called the Market Castle, which took up the entire low hilltop. The town sprawled comfortably around its base. The road travelling east and west through Barrowbell, linking the rivers, is filled with travellers day and night. So important is it to commerce. The road is travelled to the point where it's one of the few places in the duchies when investment in permanent mage lighting is actually cost-effective. Pre-Irionite, that is. Now I could light the whole town up before lunch. The road to Barrowbell is a kind of idiom in Alsha, as well as a folk song, meaning an unexpected and exciting and often dangerous adventure. A husband might get home after being robbed and beaten, for example, and claim, "I was walking the road to Barrowbell tonight." "Can not Barrowbell see to its defence?" I asked. I'd only been in sight of the place once in my journeys and never visited. They have to have plenty of folk there who can swing a sword. The folk of Barrowbell are merchants and artisans and tax counters, not warriors, Telemann said. They take up arms as they will, but mostly they either flee or continue with business as usual. We have to send someone strong to see to their defence. I suggest one of the Censorate war magi, perhaps Flinnerton. I plan to take a position at Castle Cambrian, 60 miles north, and do my best to screen Barrowbell as long as I can. It's not ideal defensively, but with the number of cavalry I have at my command right now, it should be sufficient. "I trust your judgment," I told him, "but keep me informed. If they take Barrowbell, then driving them back will be our grandchildren's job, if we're lucky enough to have them." "When can we get more troopsmen?" Telemann nearly begged. "I can't hold out with a bunch of foppish Gilmoran gentlemen who only know how to fight each other and a bunch of terrified peasants who have never held a spear. If a dragon falls out of the sky, they'll all shit themselves before they can use one." "I don't have the answer to that. Talk to Count Sago. He's in charge of troops, and any answer he gives you will be wrong. So when will you visit the field yourself? A lot of us would like to see you, myself included." "I'm getting my house in order," I said defensively. "Trust me, after Timberwatch I needed a rest." "I'm not denying that," Telemann said, "and I'm not saying it isn't well deserved. I just think we need you, or at least want you to be here." "So does my wife." "I understand. I will see what I can do. But unless you can think of something out there only I can do, I'm probably of more use here at the moment. In the meantime, how do you propose to stop the Barrowbell column?" "With everything I have. I've got 6 war magi in that area already. I can get a few more there, and maybe they can figure out something clever if I fail. But right now, the summer looks like it's going to be a big, ugly 10,000 goblin parade right through the prettiest part of Gilmora." He sounded mournful. I got a little irritated, partially because he was absolutely right, and I felt guilty about it. "I've been doing what I can. Did I mention the Censorate tried to arrest me in the middle of a fair? And I'm reorganizing the magical administrative infrastructure of 3 duchies, and the birth of my son turned my castle white and lowered the magical resistance on my domain? Oh, and His Grace is quietly killing anyone who gets between him and a crown? Look, I know having me there would be helpful to morale, but we still have foes to the rear, and we still need to develop the institutions necessary to sustain this war. If you really think one more war mage will make a difference..." "No, probably not. At least not a big difference. I'll see what else I can do. I just thought I'd better tell you. We need help, and those Castalli troops Rad told us he was amassing aren't going to get here in time. Not by months. That is, unless the Gavani take Barrowbell, then they'll be a whole lot closer." He ended the spell without further discussion. Touchy. But I could see his point. As I conjured the mage map I was using to keep up with the situation to update it, I realized what Telemann was up against. The route down the lumber road toward Barrowbell was long, and there were literally hundreds of places along the twisty Piedmont where a whole legion could hide in ambush. Once they got to the riverlands, however, there were few natural defences, and damn few man-made ones. The few castles along the way were more toll collectors than defensive structures. People in the Mesopotamian region wanted to make money, not fight. The keep, designed to protect Barrowbell, was huge, built back when Gilmora was still an Alshari possession. But as sturdy as the famed Market Castle was, Barrowbell itself didn't have more than a token garrison. The town policed itself, and the guards were there to apprehend cut purses and enforce trade regulation, not defend the town to the death. There were plenty of nobles in the area, even knights, but Barrowbell was a town of commerce, not war. The local nobility was skilled at killing each other off in tournaments or duels, but apart from a few dynastic feuds and the occasional bit of raw conquest, they were not adept at warfare. From what I had been told, Barrowbell could likely raise 2, maybe 3,000 trained fighting men to defend the city, and perhaps thrice more in merchant levies. The guilds of a chartered town were responsible, under their charter, for raising militia troops in a time of war. And while a bunch of bakers and shoemakers might not inspire fear in the heart of the average knight, some of the merchant levies were decent soldiers once you put a spear in their hands. Between that and the strength of Market Castle, barring the intervention of dragons, the folk of Barrowbell might just be able to weather an invasion and save their lives, if not their rich city. And while they might be able to save themselves behind their castle's walls, that didn't mean that they would have won. If the goblins sacked Barrowbell, the warehouses there alone could supply them for a year or two without having to forage further. They would be able to amass troops there and strike at any major region of the Riverlands, with the folk of Barrowbell huddling in their castle until starvation forced them to contend with their besiegers. I suppressed a shudder. I knew how that negotiation was likely to go. Into the soup pot. I was contemplating that ugly scenario when the second call came, from Penny.
"Min, it's me," she said unnecessarily.
Every stone-to-stone contact has a unique feel to it. It was easier to know who was speaking into your mind than it was to guess who was standing behind you.
"I'm settling into my new manor, just outside of Castabriel. The capital is blistering this time of year," she said happily.
Penny loves heat.
"How did you get a manor?" "I'm rich," she reminded me patiently. "Filthy. So I just bought it. I can do that now, thanks to you overturning the bans. It's lovely, too. Just the cutest little..."
"Is there a reason for this talk, or did you just want to brag about your excellent taste in real estate?" I interrupted.
"Yes, there's a reason. I have news from the capital. The Duke has returned from the summer palace at Wilderhall. He's managed to raise almost 30,000 troops there, and another 15,000 or 20,000 north of there, in the Castali Wilderlands. They will march, eventually, in support of the troops from the south he is sending. Eventually. But he views the encroachment into his new lands with alarm, and he is vexed about it."
"Well, at least he's paying attention."
"Not so much attention that he still can't plan his coronation, but that's going to be difficult if the goblins actually take his capital before he can get the crown on his head. The whole city is abuzz about the Coronet Council, and word has already leaked out. His Grace also requested, through Master Dunsellin, that the Arcane Orders kindly get off our collective ass and do something about it."
"I hope you informed them we're producing high magi as fast as we can, and..."
"He knows all of that, Min, but he has to ask. I warned you this would happen back at Robin Wing. The kingdom is going to ask for our help in response to the dragons, and we've just got to have something we can show them. Otherwise we could be facing a revolt in the middle of an invasion. The dragons are problematic, but the goblins are the bigger threat. We've been doing all we can," I said plaintively. "We have to find a way to do more. Min, could we ask the tree folk for help?"
I thought about that for a moment. It wasn't a bad idea. Humanity had always been on reasonably good terms with the tree folk, ever since the Void spawned us on Kalador. They taught us about magic, for instance, and they've shared a wealth of poetry and literature with us. According to legend, they gifted us with ancient Perwin, and then when we stupidly sank the island, they let us settle the Majocracy on the mainland. They had a treaty with the Imperial Majocracy for centuries that kept humanity within its bounds, more or less. There was an official ambassador of the Elka Alon at the court of the Archmage right up to the conquest. But after that stunning defeat, the Elka Alon had withdrawn from humanity's affairs, retreated to their glades, groves, forests, and hidden cities,
and let us destroy our ancient civilization in peace. Only recently, since the dead god had risen, had they taken a new interest in us. Would they aid us? I had seen some very brave Alka die fighting Sherul in the most powerful magical battle in history. They were brave, they could fight, and they knew far more about magic than our greatest Archmagi ever did. It was clear when I spoke to them about the dead god. They were afraid of Sherul. Would they aid us against the goblins who fought for him, though? Or the dragons? They might have some answers at that. Several of the oldest Alka Alon sagas had various kings using dragons against each other. That's why they were so interesting. It certainly couldn't hurt to try to talk to them about it, would it? That's not a bad idea. When the Alka reshaped my stone into the witch sphere, they did say I could use it to contact them at need. I think this qualifies. All right, I'll do that as soon as I deal with this idiot and get back to the castle. What idiot? I suppressed a groan. I hadn't meant to mention my troubles to her. Nothing important. Just a dispute with a neighbor. The last thing I wanted was Penny's advice on this. Her family had managed lands, even though the active Magi in her family could not technically own them, for hundreds of years, and Penny took an aristocratic approach to such things. Hearing that I was in a scrap with the Warbird over my tiny fief would have amused her, but it would be embarrassing. I was the head of the Arcane Orders and the first High Mage, and I should be able to handle this.
Min, are you having problems?
Nothing I can't handle. I've got bigger things to think about. This would be a pleasant distraction if it wasn't for the heat. I had to try to maintain tight control when I spoke to Penny by mind, because increasingly, as I was playing with my son these days, I had been wondering about his possible half-sibling that should be being born around now, and I knew Penny knew at least some information about where Isili, the Shadow Mage assassin who was working for Duke Rad, was hiding out. I had not brought the subject up with Penny, because she didn't think I knew. But every time I was speaking with her through the stones, there was a danger she'd be able to pick up on my unasked questions and determine the subject. Look, this has been very productive, but my squire has signalled that the idiot I'm supposed to be negotiating with has finally arrived, so we need to finish this later.
Your squire? You're taking this whole night mage thing pretty seriously.
He's not officially my squire. He's just the newest young war mage to be tested for gaining a stone. I like to work them a little bit before I just hand one over. A few days in service to a mage lord helps give them exposure and practice. Nice kid, named Beethless, from somewhere in Wenshaw. He's more than qualified, though, and I just gave him his stone last night. I'll be sending him along in the next few days.
I've been thinking of taking an apprentice lately myself, if I can find a worthy one. I take it such a candidate would be high on the list for a witch stone?
Why, Penny, are you going to abuse the sacred trust of your position to advance your personal interests? That's really my only motivation for having a position, she pointed out. I can't argue with that, I admitted, but I've got to go. My neighbor just showed up. He doesn't look happy.
You have that effect on people, she commented, and then ended the connection.
Mage Lord?
Asked Beethless, earnestly.
Are you all right?
Communicating stone to stone. Order, business. You'll get used to it soon enough. I looked up at the far end of the field where some project of Master Olmeg's was growing. I had no idea what it might be, but it was starting to look less like a vegetable garden and more like, well, a very poorly tended shrubbery garden. Whatever the enchantments my green mage had used had the saplings and shrubs leaping up out of the ground, and the ground cover advancing like it was marching. He had politely requested an inspection tour of the project tomorrow, and I looked forward to hearing why he had planted so extensively in such an unlikely place. The Westflarians took no notice of it, thankfully. A column of nine, all armored and arrayed for war, followed a monk on a mule. It was a coin toss as to which looked more irritated. Land Brother Meissen was dressed in his homespun brown robe, a silver plough embroidered on his breast. He was bald, or wore a tonsure, and rode with his hood up to protect his pate from the sun. He bore a staff with a white flag on it, and when he dismounted, he spoke a prayer before settling the staff into the ground.
Mage Lord Minelan,
I come bearing a peace proposal, the middle-aged monk began. With your permission, I invoke the peace of Huin on this place, for this time. I took out my mage blade and stabbed it into the earth. Until you depart in peace, land brother, I will observe the peace of Huin, I said. Beethless likewise stuck his sword in the earth. He was the son of a Wenshari lord, and was familiar with the land father's truce. Sire Gimbal, Sir Brommel, and their knights filed in behind them, including Sire Mutaran, the lord of Bastador, who looked at me grimly. One by one they agreed to hear the proposal in peace, and sheathed their swords in the earth. Now, let's get down to the business of restoring the life-giving waters to their proper state. Mage Lord Minilan, the terms I deem most fair, and those which Sire Gimbal and his vassal have agreed to, include you releasing the waters of the Keta to flow in their natural course, at their natural rate. In return, Sire Gimbal declares under the sight of Huin and the rest of the gods that he will cease harassing your frontiers. He will return the tolls through Bastador and his other domains to their normal rate, and he will stop pursuing the contested land of Brestal Vale. This peace would hold through the harvest, at which point the two of you may invoke Huin's and my oversight of a more permanent solution. I considered. Clearly, the monk had worked hard to get Gimbal to agree to this, and the fact that he was here at all bore testament at just how much my damming of the Keta was costing the folk of Bastador, and further downstream. I could tell as much by looking at the face of its lord, Sire Mutaran, who seemed awfully anxious that his liege would mess this negotiation up. I suppose, for the love I bear the god Huin, I said, although I barely thought about the landfather, I will accede to these terms. There was a look of palpable relief on Motaran's face, and Brother Meissen quickly unfurled the scroll with the details of the agreement, and offered to read it to me if I did not have my letters. I'll sign and seal it, I assured him. I trust you on your word, land brother. Sire Gimbal stepped forward and also signed it, and then we both appended our seals, his with the traditional lamp of wax, me by magically altering the paper to draw a stylized snowflake over my signature. I do hope this means we can put this behind us, I said, with false friendliness, when the deed was done and land brother Meissen prayed over the scroll. Until harvest, spellmonger, the man growled, and pulled his sword out of the dirt with open disdain for me, before he stalked off to mount his horse. Sir Brommel witnessed his liege's signature, as did Sire Mutaran, before they each picked up their swords and joined their master without further discussion. The others followed suit. The monk, on the other hand, didn't seem in a hurry to go. Indeed, the moment they were out of sight, he stretched and yawned and sighed happily. Oh, Huin sweaty sack, good riddance! I had to endure that man's company for 2 days to get him to come here. I'd rather put a plough through broken glass. So you're the mage lord everyone is so worked up about, the monk said, eyeing me thoughtfully as he rolled up the treaty scroll and shoved it in a pouch on his mule. A bit younger than I expected. Thought you'd have a long white beard. If I had to wait much longer for the war bird, I might have. I was growing older by the minute, and more parched by the second. Can I invite you inside for a cool drink of ale, land brother? The gift of Huin, he nodded, smiling. Blessed is his name, blessed his drink. It would be rude of me to say no. I escorted the man through the gates, my apprentice, high mage, following dutifully behind me. Brother Meissen was shocked at the rapid progress that had been made in Sevendor, starting with the dyke tower that had seemed to spring out of nowhere, to the reoccupied site of Brestal Farms, now known as Bovall Hall, to the improvements we'd made to the road and bridge to Brestal. I confess, I would have passed right by the vale had I not known it was behind that wall. Amazing! And the things that I've heard from the people, the wonders you have wrought. Dear Huin, your crops are magnificent. Are they the product of magic? They're mostly the product of knowing what kinds of grain prosper in Sevendor's clime and soil. For that I have Master Olmeg, my green warden, but he does use a few spells in his work, at need. I don't mind telling you, Mage Lord, he said, as he followed me into the tower's guardroom, where I had an earthenware bottle of ale waiting, That Sire Gimbal. He's a nasty one. He only consented to the agreement when poor Lord Mortaran came to Flaria and begged on behalf of his people. I have no quarrel with Mortaran, I agreed. I'd only met the man once before, at the Chepstone Fair, but unlike his master, he'd struck me as a reasonable sort. Like Festeran's father, he was a decent man who was making the best of being a vassal to a poor lord. And I hated to make his people suffer, but the truth was, we needed the water. I've built a pond and had to fill it. It was but a few weeks' worth, I dismissed, although I knew how critical water could be in agriculture. I suppose I should fix that now. The reservoir was now almost half full. I mentally contacted Tyndall, who was on station in Sevendor Village, and instructed him to open the sluice. And now I have fulfilled my part of the treaty. The Keta flows again, as you will see in a moment. In truth, I was pleased that you found a way to resolve the dispute without further recourse to arms, he admitted, taking a seat as I poured the ale. The land needs water to sprout seed, not blood. An innovative approach, he said approvingly, before blessing our beer. He took a sip with obvious delight. It's been 2 years since I've been here, and the last time Sir Aaron Tal tried to have me thrown out. Whatever demons you might be in league with, this member of Huin's clergy is convinced you did the Vales a boon. It was a pleasure, and feel free to tarry in Brestall as long as you'd like, as well as Sevendor. In fact, we have a man who wishes to take orders under the plough in the new village. Would you consent to examine him, and if he is found ready, ordain him? A Sevendore? He asked, surprised. No, a Bavali. Goodman Tevram, a widowed freeholder too lame to plough himself. But he began studying last year with the monk of Huin, and I would consider it a boon if he were ordained in your order, as he desires. I've even gone so far as to dedicate a temple, a cot, and 3 acres to his upkeep. And, of course, I added, I'll pay his ordination fees. Land Brother Meissen looked pleased. Why, I am always happy to bring another brother to the plough, he said, slapping the table earnestly. And we haven't had so much as a shrine in this vale in memory. He stopped and suddenly looked concerned. I do hope you realize that this will not be able to sway me in judgment, should you and the warbird quarrel again. It is for my own selfish desires to have the people of Sevendor and Brestall ministered to by competent clergy. There were few records kept in the villages, and almost as few in the castle. My folk need someone to tend their rights, marry them, bury them, and help them tend their fields. And I don't need to bribe a monk when my cause is just. A noble and virtuous attitude, Mage Lord. Then I would see this man of yours and speak to him of taking orders, he agreed, after a few more cups and the exchange of some news. He was interested in all that had happened in the Vales since my arrival, and asked about several of the Brestali and a few of the Sevendori. As the second cup passed his lips, he began listing the deficiencies of Sir Erenthal in language not usually associated with the clergy. One particular item of note came up when the monk was finishing his third mug of ale. Under the discipline of my order, I cannot part in any dispute between noble houses, the land brother said cagily, and anything told to me in confidence is, of course, held in trust. But I do think you're a wise man, Mage Lord, and you have greatly benefited these people whom you owed nothing to. Such grace is rare, particularly among the nobility. So I don't feel amiss mentioning that while Sire Gimbal had me cooling my heels at his castle, I couldn't help but notice that there were other visitors. Others. Two gentlemen. I'm just a simple rural monk, but I had the distinct impression they were there on business. What sort of business? I asked, curious. What was Brother Meissen getting at? I know not, Mage Lord. As I said, I am a simple rural monk. Interfering in the realms of Duin and Luin is proscribed by my order, but I couldn't help but note how stylish they were dressed. From the cut of their clothes, I would guess that they were late from Rhemir. He fixed me with a pointed stare. Their checkered cloaks looked particularly dashing on such stalwart-looking gentlemen as they.
That news created a sour taste in my mouth. Checkered cloaks, you say. Land Brother Meissen nodded, meaningfully, and richly appointed. Why, they nearly jingled at the amount of coin they seemed to carry. That was important news. It's rarely a good thing when your enemies start conspiring against you. If the censorate could not come after me directly, I knew they were more than willing to fight me by proxy, and they had the money to do it. The most I could do was count on Sire Gimbal's greed and surliness to alienate the censorate, or the censorate's high-handed ways to irritate Sire Gimbal. Either or both were likely, but would it be enough to keep them from adding their strength to one another? Brother Meissen and I made small talk, during which time I realized just why the monk was so popular. He always seemed to be on your side, and he acted as if he had nothing but your best interest at heart. He genuinely believed in the God of the land, and he believed in the instructions of his order wholeheartedly, but that did not keep him from being a shameless gossip. In my case, I felt as if the monk actually did have my best interests at heart. The improvement of his kinfolk's lot in life was more than enough to convince him of my good intentions, and he approved of the respectful way I spoke of the villagers, both villain and free. I got the distinct impression that if there was anything he could do to favour Sevendor, he would. To prove his convictions, even before he set off to see his kinfolk in Brestol, he asked to meet a candidate for ordination. Brother Meissen revealed that he would enjoy having more priests around, especially at plough time, to keep up with the benedictions and blessings, and having one tender shrine in his homeland was particularly pleasing. I escorted him to the cot behind the unfinished shrine, where I introduced him to Goodman Tevrem. The two men immediately set to discussion of things divine, and Brother Meissen agreed to begin his examinations the next day. Once done, I called Beethless, who had been waiting patiently and improving the Dyke Tower's magical defences while I had spoken to the monk.
"Yes, Mage Lord,"
he asked eagerly. "I have a task for you. Your final examination before I release you to the penumbra," I sighed. "I wish you to stealthily follow Sire Gimbal and discover the identity of two recent visitors of his. Then I wish for you to gather as much information as you can about whatever arrangements they made with Sire Gimbal. And just to give you some notice, the gentlemen in question were wearing checkered cloaks." The young Wenshari war mage's eyes widened, and then narrowed in anticipation.
"I shall be delighted to fulfil your quest, Mage Lord," he agreed, and then went to beg a horse from the Dyke Tower stable.
I stopped back at the shrine myself, before I continued on toward the castle, just to take a look inside. Unfinished and as rude as a villain's hut, the shrine nonetheless was decorated with spring flowers and sweet-smelling herbs. A stylized plough made of wood had been set up on the altar, along with the elements of the sacraments of Huin. Offerings of barley and wheat and oats stood in small bowls. Tevrem would add them to his meagre allotment later. Being a monk is rarely a life of plenty, even for those who oversaw the spiritual needs of the farmers. It was a hopeful sign, however, that the shrine was so well attended. The folk of Bovell Hall were investing in this new land, even as they pined for their old. Being willing to share their rations with the man and the god demonstrated just how committed they were to beginning life anew in Sevendor. I stopped and offered a prayer to the Earthlord, though I knew few of his standards. My folk were devoted to Brigga, the flame that burneth bright. But every baker respects those who grow the grain they bake, and I was feeling particularly thankful just then, for no particular reason. The Keta was already flowing steadily again when I crossed it on my way back to the castle. That seemed like a sign from the god, even though I knew why and how it had been restored. I chose to take it as a good sign. I could do that. Mage Lord's prerogative.